Well, now put your hand up if the book of Numbers is your favorite book in the Bible. Nobody? Now, I won't ask you, I won't embarrass you, but put your hand up if you think you could quote a text from the book of Numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Well, that's why we're going to study it. It's part of God's Word, and every part of God's Word is helpful and important. So we're going to look at this. It is not well known. There are only two verses that are widely quoted. One is, "What hath God wrought?" Or in its modern translation, "See what God has done." It was on the 24th of May, 1844, that the very first electric telegraph message was sent to the city of Washington in America. And the man who sent it was a man called Morse. And from him we get the Morse code. And in fact, the first electronic message was in Morse. But it was that very verse, "What hath God wrought?" And Morse attributed the discovery of electronic message communication to God. He realized that it was God who put all that power in. It's rare today to find people making discoveries, attributing them to God. Look what God has done. It's nowadays, look what man has done. Look what we can do. But Morse, at least, was a godly man. The other text that I think many people know but don't know comes from Numbers is, "Be sure your sin will find you out." I gave up smoking at the age of 9. It was on the same day that I took it up, and I could take you to the very bushes where 4 of us smuggled a box of cigarettes and smoked the lot and were sick as dogs. I've never wanted one since. Now, smoking won't take you to hell, but it makes you smell as if you've already been there. But I happened to say this in Derby City Hall, and a Methodist pastor on the platform leapt off his seat and said, "David, I was one of the other 3 with you." And he'd forgotten about it all those years. "Be sure your sin will find you out." But do you know what sin that verse originally referred to? Probably not. Well, there are some books in the Bible we don't get into and others we do. Let's get into the book of Numbers. Strange title for a book. And of course, in the Hebrew, it isn't that title because they use just the first words of the scroll, and the first words are "the Lord said." So that's what this book is called in Hebrew. But again, when the Hebrew was translated into the Greek, they had to think of a new title. So they called it Arithmoi. Well, you can guess what that word means in Greek, because from that we get arithmetic, and hence it became the book of Numbers. And I suppose it's called that because it begins and ends with numbers, with 2 census. I'm not sure what the plural of census is, so will censi, would it be? I don't know. There were 2 censuses. One at the beginning of Numbers and one at the end. And they were, of course, military census. They were for purposes of military conscription. And therefore, they only counted the men over 20 who were fighting fit. And the number at the beginning and end of the book is around 600,000. That's how we know there were over 2 million people. If you included the women and children, all under 20, then you come to a figure of 2 million plus. But 600,000 fighting men. I sometimes use this as a kind of ready reckoner for the strength of a church. How many men are there in this church over 20 who are able to fight for the Lord? It's not a bad test of the strength of a church. But let's look at the census here. The first census in the first chapter is 603,550. That's when they left Sinai. At the end of the book, another census is taken, and it's 601,730, which is a loss of 1,800. But you've got to remember that those 2 countings, those 2 numberings, were 40 years apart. Now, the numbers have proved a real talking point. It is the book of Numbers, after all, which tells us that there's nothing wrong in counting. All fishermen count. And that's why on the day of Pentecost, somebody sort of said 2,998, splash, 2,999, splash, 3,000. There's nothing wrong with counting. Shepherds have to count sheep, fishermen have to count fish. I'm sure you've heard of the one-armed fisherman who caught a fish that big, but anyway. It's normal for fishermen and shepherds to count. Nothing wrong with counting, unless you are counting for the motivation of pride. And that's when King David came unstuck. And King David counted his troops after he won the battle. He should have counted them before. Jesus said, no man going to battle doesn't sit down first and count his troops to see whether he's got more than the enemy. So they were counting their troops before battle and numbering the fighting men of Israel before they had to meet an enemy. Now, many people say the number is far too large. They say the population under the monarchy later was only 1,300,000. They say the population is said in the book of Deuteronomy to be much smaller than the Canaanites. So how big were the Canaanites? Millions. They say it's impossible for 70 families who came to Egypt to produce this many. They say it's too many for the wilderness of Sinai. There was no valley in the wilderness of Sinai big enough to contain such numbers. So there have been many, many objections. But we have the word of God saying so. And once again, you have to make your choice. Do you believe this or not? I believe God is perfectly capable of sustaining any number of people because he's God. Notice that it's such a similar number at the beginning and the end of the 40 years. Only 1,800 difference in 2 million or in 600,000 fighting men. Whereas in Egypt, they multiplied tremendously from just a few families to 2 million in 400 years. I know it's a tenth of the time, but it's not even a tenth of the increase. That tells us something. One tribe decreased by 37,000, but another increased by 20,500. So it evened out. And they finished up at the end of Numbers with the same number as they had at the beginning. That tells us that God was not blessing them. For where God blesses, people multiply. If God blesses a church, it gets bigger. If he's not blessing, it tends to stay the same. Blessing of God is seen in fruitfulness. And there's very little blessing of God in the book of Numbers. Maybe that's why we don't like it. But the point I want to make is this. The 600,000 at the end of this book are totally different from the 600,000 at the beginning, except for two individuals. They have completely changed. Now, of course, in those days, people didn't usually live beyond about 60. That was the life expectancy. Moses and Joshua after him lived to 120. That was incredible. At that time, 60 would be about the life expectancy of a man. And therefore, 600,000 men over 20, 40 years later, have all gone. Only two survived, Joshua and Caleb. So that we don't realize when we read through a book like this, you're covering 40 years, more than a generation. Generations reckoned at 30 years. So only two survived. And this highlights the major tragedy of this book. I think this is the saddest book in the Old Testament. Now you may think Lamentations is pretty grim, but I think this is the saddest from the point of view of the story. You see, two-thirds of the book of Numbers should never have been written. Two-thirds of the events described here should never have happened. They are not part of God's purpose. He never intended the book of Numbers to be written. But we have it because the Bible is a very honest book. So what has happened? The tragedy is that the journey from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, which is the first oasis after the Negev Desert, the first sign of real life, and the beginning of the promised land of Canaan, from Sinai to Kadesh takes 11 days on foot. That's all. Less than a fortnight, and they could have been living on milk and honey and not on, what is it? Manna. And yet we find that instead of 11 days, it took 13,780 days to make it into the promised land. Now, looking at the map, this was the direct route, 11 days. The route they actually took was to turn away from Kadesh and go across this deep valley, this rift valley that goes right down through Africa, the biggest crack in the earth's surface, and they crossed that into the mountains, the other side, the mountains of Edom, and then they finished up in Moab on the wrong side of the River Jordan. Now, if you look at the distance, you'd have thought, if that's 11 days, then that's no more than maybe 2 weeks. But they took nearly 40 years, 38 years and a few months, from there to there. Now, why? Was it a particularly difficult piece of country? No. It was the fact that God didn't move. And he only moved a little at a time, and he stayed a very long time in each place, and they didn't dare move if God didn't. The pillar of cloud stayed. And he literally delayed their journey for 40 years, and he told them why he delayed it. I am going to slow you up now until every man among you is dead, except two, Joshua and Caleb. That's pretty tough. And it meant that an entire generation was left doing nothing for the rest of their lives, getting nowhere, doomed to futility, which is a very tough sentence, and we need to feel it. How would you like to be told you are now redundant until you die? There's nothing more for you to do. Just get up in the morning, go to bed at night. Nothing. Nothing to live for. Devastating. But that's what God did. Now, what happened at Kadesh to cause that? Well, if you know your Bible, you know exactly what happened. They refused to go in when God told them to. And they missed it. The tragedy is there are some opportunities in life. If you miss them, you can never have them again. They come once. And if you don't seize it, then God may never give you that chance again. We need to take that seriously. How important it is when God says, move, move. When God says, go in and take something, then go in and take it. Otherwise, you could spend the rest of your life in a wilderness, getting nowhere. Horrible place to be, because it's what the Yorkshire people say, it's neither mount nor summit. It's neither one thing nor the other. They were neither in Egypt nor Canaan. And that's why a lot of Christians, you know, are very miserable people, because they're in between. They've got out of sin, so they don't enjoy that anymore. But they haven't got into the blessing that God has for them, so they don't enjoy that either. And then nobody's so miserable as somebody who's got out but hasn't got in. And some people are stuck there for the rest of their lives and die in that miserable wilderness where there's just nothing really happening. Well, that's the tragedy. And 2/3 of the book of Numbers is about the journey from there to there, which need never have happened. And therefore, the main lessons that we learn from the book of Numbers are negative. The Bible is a very honest book. Thank God for that. It tells you not only about the great successes and virtues, it tells you about the failures and the vices. It tells you the things that went wrong as well as the things that went right. And Paul, writing to the Corinthians, talks about the book of Numbers, and he says this: now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting on our hearts on evil things as they did. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings to us. Now, you couldn't have a clearer statement of the purpose of the book of Numbers. It may not be popular, you may not enjoy reading it, but it's terribly important, because if you don't study history, you're condemned to repeat it. In fact, a friend of mine has written a little poem that goes, history repeats itself. It has to. No one listens. And there's a very real sense in which reading the history of Israel, if you read it properly, you will not make the same mistakes that they did. So it's a book about their failures, their follies, their mistakes, even Moses. Moses was not permitted to go into the promised land. Moses himself. He did get into it centuries later when he talked with Jesus. But he had to wait centuries to get into it, because he too failed miserably at one crucial point, as we shall see. Well, now that's why we read the book of Numbers. I'm afraid we're reading it to learn from their mistakes and what went wrong and need not be written about us, but it could be. It's a mixture of narrative and legislation, but whereas in Exodus the first half was all narrative or story and the second half is all law, here it's all mixed up. And it goes from a little bit of story to a little bit of legislation, back to a bit of story, back to legislation. Now, the author of all the laws is not Moses, but God. 80 times in this book, 80 times, it says, God said to Moses. And that leads into law and legislation, the way that to live. The narrative, it says, Moses kept a diary, a journal of their travels. At the Lord's command. He also kept another book called the Book of the Wars of the Lord. And that was a book of all the accounts of the battles they had with other people, the use of those fighting men that they'd conscripted through the census. Now here is one of the five books of Moses. And it's this complete mix-up between legislation and narrative. But before we look at that, let's see how it fits in to the four books that Moses wrote about events during his lifetime. Moses led them out of Egypt and all the way to the plains of Moab in the Jordan Valley, but on the wrong side of the Jordan. So this covers Moses' life. And you'll see the book of Numbers covers a huge chunk of that. Probably the greatest part of their 40 years in the wilderness you'll find in the book of Numbers. Now notice the red and the green, the red and the green, the red and the green, the red. The red stands for the times when they were camped and stationary. The green describes their travels. So they camped, then they traveled, they camped and they traveled, they camped and they traveled. Now the interesting thing is that all the legislation, the laws were given to them while they were camped. And then all the stories of their travels show how they broke those laws. So while they were camped and stationary, God told them what they should do. But while they moved, we have a story of what they did do, which was a little different from what they should. And so you have a kind of multiple-layered sandwich. So in Egypt, the book of Exodus 1 to 11, they're stationed in Egypt. Exodus 12 to 18, they're moving to Sinai. Exodus 19 to 40, they're stationary at Sinai. Leviticus 1 to 7, they're still at Sinai. Numbers 1 to 10, they're still at Sinai. So all that is stationary, and it's just packed with legislation. God gave them the laws when they were sitting still. So, if you like, they were still to hear from God, and then they got up to walk in God's ways, only they usually didn't. But you see the difference between sitting and listening to God and then getting up to walk the way he told us to walk. Numbers 10 to 12 then, they're on the move again. From Sinai to Kadesh, 11 days journey. Kadesh, the big crisis occurs. And God speaks to them a lot at Kadesh from chapters 13 to 20. We're going to look at that very carefully. What did God say to them at Kadesh? That was so significant. Then they're on the move again. Numbers 20 to 21. They're from Kadesh to Moab. Notice that that whole journey is covered only by two chapters. It really wasn't significant. Wasn't important to God. Yet there are some things said in those two chapters we need to learn. And finally they settle in Moab. And they've reached the very border of the Promised Land for the second time. They were at the border then, but they didn't go in. They're at the border again now, but now there's the Jordan in flood between them and the Promised Land. They would never have had that barrier to face had they gone straight in. And Numbers 22 to 36 are entirely what God said to them while they waited to go in. And the whole of Deuteronomy 1 to 34 belongs to that same stationary time again. So can you see that Numbers has a lot of movement in it? Deuteronomy has nothing. Exodus has the first half. But there is this clear pattern. When they were still, God spoke to them and said, now this is how you should live. When they got up to move, that's when they got into trouble and walked in their own ways instead of the ways of the Lord. So we have a lot to learn from all this. Let's look first at the legislation in the book of Numbers. That's not the less interesting, so I thought we'd take it first. And then we'll look at the narrative, which contains some fascinating stories. But let's look at the legislation. And the first thing that hits us with the laws in Numbers is that these are not moral laws or social laws or what we call judicial laws, not criminal laws at all. Now, in Exodus, they were. But here, they are mostly ritual laws, laws about worship. Now, in the law of Moses, all these different kinds of law are mixed up. They didn't draw the distinction that we draw between criminal law for the state and canon law for the church. They didn't have that kind of thinking. For them, all of life was one whole. And so moral laws and judicial laws and social laws and ritual laws are all mixed up. But we tend to compartmentalize life and we say that's criminal law and this is religious law. But they didn't do that. God was interested in all of life. And so 80 times God spoke to Moses, it says mouth to mouth or face to face. A very intimate phrase. God gave these laws very directly to Moses. And Moses was face to face with God. We read that when he came back down the mountain, his face was luminous. It shone. The glory was still reflected in it. He had this intimate face-to-face encounter with God. And God told him all about the construction of the tabernacle and all the rest of it. And said, I'm now living among the people. But there is one huge danger when God came down from the mountain to live in his own tent in the middle of the camp. The danger was that with God so near to them, people would take him for granted. People would become over-familiar with God. And when they became over-familiar, they would lose reverence and respect. God would be too near to them. They wouldn't feel the gulf between their sinfulness and his holiness. I think there's a very, very relevant message somewhere here that we need to listen to. When God is too near, we take him for granted. He's among us. Great. And we become over-familiar. And especially we forget his holiness. We think of his love and his compassion, his kindness and his goodness. But we overlook his holiness. And that's what makes him different from us. Well now, all the legislation in the book of Numbers, I believe, is given to prevent them from losing their reverence for God. And I'm going to classify it under three headings, which we need to remember today. One, carefulness. Two, cleanliness. And three, costliness. And all the laws in Numbers can be put under one of those three heads. That when you have God among you, you need to remember first that you still need to be careful how you approach him. Second, that you need to be clean when you come to him. And third, that it is costly not to be holy yourself. Now let's look at those three things in the book of Numbers. First, when they were camped, they had to be very, very careful to camp in the right place around his tent. And this was the order that is given in the book of Moses. Each tribe had its own specific allotted place in relation to God's tent and the entrance to God's tent. And generally speaking, the most important place is right in front of the entrance. And the most important tribe was Judah. And Judah had to be directly always in front of the entrance to God's place. It would be from the tribe of Judah that later Jesus would come. Well, so Judah had to be here. Then the importance of the tribes is always in an anti-clockwise direction. And we notice this. But the four most important tribes actually had to be at the four corners. The other tribes in an anti-clockwise direction of value. There was an order, there was a hierarchy among the 12 tribes, and God laid that hierarchy down. And he said it's very important that these four tribes guard the... They are the nearest on the four sides to the tent, ones at the corner are further off. But between all these 12 tribes and God's tent, there had to be, as it were, a barrier of Levites. And even among the Levites, there were three sub-tribes or clans, and the different clans had to be in a particular position. Moses and Aaron and the priests had to guard the entrance, so their tents must be here. And of course there's the double entrance into the holy place and then the holy of holies. So God is protected by his people. Now the interesting thing is that archaeologists have found out how the ancient armies camped, how Pharaoh camped his different troops, his infantry and cavalry and so on. And this is exactly the military camp pattern of the ancient Egyptian army, which Moses may well have been trained in the university. But it's as if God is saying, my people are an army. And it's very important that the camp be rightly protected. And when the camp moved, it's fascinating, it's a bit complicated, you need to read it in Numbers. But some tribes had to go before God's tabernacle pieces were carried. Other tribes had to go. But they sort of unpeeled like an orange. And they marched in that order, following each other. So when they got to the camp, it was simplicity itself for each tribe to stop and put their tents up. The whole thing is minutely detailed. And who had to carry which piece of furniture from the tabernacle, and who had to carry the curtains, and what order they had to be carried in. Everything was so detailed. Well, now, why is God so fussy, so particular? Well, not only was it very efficient, as in all military operations, it was a very efficient way of camping, but he was saying, be careful. A careless attitude doesn't have a place in God's camp. Carelessness is a dangerous thing. If I can dare to put it in a modern word, casualness. Any old thing won't do for God. But we are becoming increasingly casual in our culture and increasingly casual in approach to God. Even in such a little thing as getting started in worship, it can become so casual that you almost drift into it, wondering when it started. Now, I think in all this, God was saying to his people, now be careful. God is in your camp. You should do things carefully, not casually, carelessly. And therefore, there are some of the sins in Numbers which are really sins of carelessness. Carelessness on the Sabbath was punishable by death. Just carelessness. Not deliberate sin, but carelessness. They were to have tassels on their clothes to remind them to pray. Vows had to be taken very seriously. If a vow was made to God, it must be kept. You remember there's a story in Judges of a man who vowed to sacrifice to God the first living thing that he met when he came home, and he met his daughter. But a vow made to God must be taken seriously. There's one very interesting qualification of that in Numbers. If a wife makes a vow to God, then her husband has 24 hours to agree with it. Or not. I think that's important. Because there are so many Christian wives with non-Christian husbands, it's important. Just occasionally a Christian wife sends us a gift for our ministry. But I always ask, have you asked your husband first? Is he behind this? So important. So a vow made by a wife has to be ratified by the husband, and there's a 24-hour cooling-off period for the husband to agree with what his wife's promised to God or not. How careful all this is. Got to do things carefully with God. The second thing that comes out to me here is cleanliness. The camp had to be spotlessly clean. These were God's people. And so even such things as the sewage arrangements, careful detail. When you are emptying your bowels, take a spade with you and go out into the desert and dig a hole and then cover up your dirt. Keep the camp clean for the Lord. It wasn't just hygiene that God was interested in. He wasn't just doing this for germs. It was because he is a clean God, and a clean camp is important. Can we put it a dirty, uncared for church building is a bit of an insult to God. That's how he was teaching them to think. And so bodily discharges were a matter for law of whatever kind. And before they left Sinai, before they went towards the promised land, God insisted that they all had a bath, that they all clean themselves up. This, of course, is why in an older day people put on clean clothes for Sunday. See? Now, we're not under that law, and so we're not under the law of Sunday clothes. Nevertheless, how we appear in worship betrays our inner mind. It says something. Do you see what I mean? And, of course, God looks on the heart. And it's cleanliness of the heart that he's after now, which is more important than cleanliness of the body. But I've noticed that people who've really been in the grip of Satan often become dirty people. Have you noticed that? And that when they're converted and truly converted, without even being told, they start cleaning themselves up. It's just an outward expression of something that's going on inside. They realize that cleanliness is next to godliness. And it's all there in the book of Numbers. Keep the camp clean. And then costliness. For a sinful person to live close to a holy God is a costly business. And this costliness was expressed in sacrifices. And on behalf of the people, sacrifices had to be offered daily, weekly, and monthly. There was a daily sacrifice. Here in the outer court on the altar, there was a weekly sacrifice and a special monthly sacrifice, so that all the time, when people realized they were losing their animals and that they were being sacrificed to God, that it was a costly matter. There's no forgiveness without blood being shed, said God. Forgiveness is very costly. Thank God it doesn't cost us anything, because it cost him everything. But if we were still living in these days, it would cost us a great deal. Our very best animals regularly. And the priesthood had to be supported. And so the priests didn't have any livelihood. And the priests and the Levites around here were supported by these tribes. The tribes paid for them to protect God's tabernacle. So it was quite a costly business. And it involved tithes and offerings and sacrifices. It was quite costly living with God in your midst. Now, all this, I think, is saying something quite profound to us. From the legislation of Numbers, I get this. We've been brought up in a day which I would say is anti-ritual, which is becoming increasingly casual and careless in its approach to God. And the book of Numbers reminds us that that won't do. That we should approach God in the right way. Let me take one example. I don't have to bring a ram or a pigeon even, or a dove, to be sacrificed when I come to God. But that doesn't mean I don't have to bring a sacrifice. There is as much sacrifice in the New Testament as in the Old. And I'm not talking about the cross now. It says, bring a sacrifice of praise. Bring a sacrifice of thanksgiving. Now, in what sense are these things a sacrifice? Well, how much did they cost you? Do you hear what I'm saying? Sacrifices were prepared for worship. Now, we don't have to prepare a lamb, but we do need to prepare praise. And sometimes I cringe when somebody says, I haven't had any time to prepare, so we're just going to let the Holy Spirit lead us. And the results are not usually complementary to the Holy Spirit. We get into ritualism if we don't have a proper approach. I believe not that worship should not be prepared at all, nor do I believe it should be all prepared by one man. But I believe everybody should prepare for an act of worship. And I hope tomorrow morning Max will be embarrassed by the number of you who want to prepare a little sacrifice of praise or thanksgiving, a reading or a song. In the New Testament it says when you come together, each one already has a song, a word, a prophecy, a tongue, an interpretation. Each one has. Not each one might get if we wait, but each one has brought. Prepare a sacrifice and come into the courts of the Lord. That's what Numbers is saying. When you come to worship, come prepared for worship. It often takes us 20 minutes to get into worship because we're not even prepared. It costs to prepare. It costs you a bit of time, a bit of thought. But it's costly to worship God in the way he wants. See, we've got into a state where I believe we want to worship God according to our taste instead of what will please him. What I like. I prefer choruses. I prefer the old hymns. Both statements are quite irrelevant. What does God want? What will please him? Doesn't matter about my feelings in worship at all. It's whether God feels good. It's whether I've blessed him. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And that's why he told them in Numbers, this is how you will bless me. This is how you worship me. Be careful, be clean, and it'll cost. But I'm a holy God living among my people, and that is necessary. Well, when we come like that, our worship becomes a fragrant offering, says the New Testament, a good smell to God. In the old days, God loved the smell of roast mutton. I do too. But it was a sweet-smelling savor to him. And our sacrifice of praise can be pleasing to God. Letter to the Hebrews says, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Now you'd have thought that was from the Old Testament. It's not. It's from the New. Let us worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. Well, we can get into disco worship and aerobic worship and all kinds of worship. But the important thing is, how does God want us to worship him? And if there's one thing he makes quite clear, it is he wants us to be prepared to worship him. Not just to turn up, but to come ready to offer a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving. Tomorrow morning, we'll have a chance to do that. All right? Well, in the next talk, we'll talk about the narrative section of the book of Numbers. We're now going to look at the narrative parts of the book of Numbers. We've looked at the legislation, all the laws that God gave, mostly ritual laws. But now we're going to look at the narrative. And we turn, therefore, from the divine word to the human deeds. It's a sad and a sordid story. We turn from what they should do to what they actually did do. See, the wilderness is a testing ground. That's why Jesus was taken into the wilderness for 6 weeks, tested. And it is a real test under very hard conditions. You're not in the promised land yet, you're out of Egypt, but you're right in between. It's like an engagement is a testing time. You're in between being free and being married. And it's a testing time because it's neither one thing nor the other. And in the same way, the wilderness is a real testing time. And alas, Israel did not pass the test. Bear in mind that after Sinai, let's go back to the map. After Sinai, they are in a different relationship to God than they were here. They commit the same sins after Sinai as they did before. The difference is that now there are sanctions, there are punishments attached to those sins, because after Sinai they are in a covenant relationship. They're now married to God. Here they were courting, if you like, but now they're married. so that now God has to deal more severely with them than he did before Sinai, because they have taken upon themselves a promise to do what he tells them, and therefore they will be blessed if they're obedient, they will be cursed if they're not. They know that, and God told them from now on, I will bless you when you do right, but I'll curse you when you do wrong. Will you accept those two conditions? And they said, we will, and we'll do what's right. But it's one thing to say that they'll do what's right, it's another thing to keep such promises. So God has actually bound himself to them in a double way, and he must now either bless them or curse them in a way that he didn't have to before. He's under obligation to his promises and to his oath. So we can see now both the purpose and the limitation of the law God gave them. The purpose is so that they can see what's right. The limitation is that they can't do it. And the law can't help them to do it. The law doesn't help you to live right. It tells you what is living right and what's wrong. But it can't help you. The law is helpless to do that. And that is why the law given on the Pentecost day was inadequate and needed later the Spirit to be given on that same day. Because without supernatural help, we'll never be able to keep the law. But they thought they could, and they promised that they would. Now we're going to look first at the leaders of the nation and see how they failed. The leaders of the nation all came from one family, two brothers and a sister. Interesting that God just used the one family to lead this new people, this new nation, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, two brothers and a sister. And we're told their good points and their strengths of character. Moses actually writes about himself and says Moses was the meekest man of all the men on earth. It's quite a thing to be able to say to yourself. You just try telling other people that you are the humblest person in your office or factory. Actually, Moses got away with it because he was. And Jesus got away with it as well. He said, learn of me, for I am meek and humble. Now, most of us couldn't even say that without being ribbed about it. But Moses could, and Jesus could. He was a meek man. By that it means he never tried to defend himself. One of the loveliest things about Moses is that when he was criticized or when he was badly treated, when he was betrayed, he never tried to defend himself. He let the Lord defend him. There's a lesson. That's what meekness is. It's not weakness, but it's not trying to defend yourself. He was both a prophet and a priest and, in a sense, a king. He combined all three functions, though he isn't called those three things. He certainly was a prophet, and he is called that, and he brought many words from the Lord. But when he prayed for the people, he was acting as a priest. And when he led them, he certainly acted as a king in battle. But he wasn't called a king. But I believe he combined all three functions. Aaron only combined two. Aaron was both a prophet to Moses and a priest. And the Aaronic priesthood became the heart of the worship and ritual of the ancient people of God. Miriam was a prophetess. So we have Moses, prophet, priest, and king, Aaron, prophet, and priest, and Miriam, prophetess. Interesting, the sharing out of the gifts. And notice that prophecy is a ministry for women as well as for men, in the New Testament as well as the Old. Philip's four daughters. And her particular prophetic gift was expressed in song. There is a very direct link between prophecy and music. Interesting that when David chose choir masters, he always chose a prophet to be a choir master, or what he called a seer, somebody who could see what God was doing. And there is a close link. Ezekiel used to say, play me some music and I'll prophesy for you. And I can understand that. There's something about music, the right kind of music, that releases the prophetic spirit. And that was true of Miriam. Now, how did they all go wrong? Well, let's do it in reverse order. Miriam went wrong because she was jealous. She desired honor for herself. And that was also going to be the end of her brother Aaron, too. Both Miriam and Aaron were jealous of Moses. Because it's not easy when you're in the same family, and your own brother has a more important position than you do. But they had important positions. They were among the leaders, but they got jealous. And Miriam was punished with leprosy. That may not be what later came to be called Hansen's disease. It could have been psoriasis or any skin disease, but certainly an incurable disease. And she had that for 7 days until she repented of it. But she actually died at Kadesh. She got no further than that. And she died there. So Miriam drops out of the picture. The second person to drop out of the leadership picture is Aaron. And once again, his problem was jealousy, desire for honor. In fact, he and Miriam got together to criticize Moses. And of course, jealousy will always find an excuse or an apparent reason for being awkward. And the reason they both found was that Moses married someone they didn't approve of. He married a Cushite woman who'd come out of Egypt with them, who was not even a Hebrew. And God didn't criticize him for doing that, but Miriam and Aaron did. It was simply an occasion. They were against Moses anyway, and this gave them a good excuse to criticize him and say he shouldn't have done that. A leader should set an example by marrying a Hebrew. Well, Aaron too died. He died at Mount Hor, which is just a little further than Kadesh. So very quickly after they expressed this jealousy and this desire for honor themselves, they both died. Aaron was over 100 when he died, which left Moses. Alas, Moses himself failed. He got very impatient with the people. Now, who could blame him? In the New Testament, it says he put up with the people for 40 years in the wilderness. And he did. I mean, what a job. 2 million people always grumbling and complaining and having arguments that needed to be settled. He would bang their heads together. He got fed up with the people and therefore impatient with them. And a leader who is impatient with his followers is likely to get into trouble. But the time came when he made a big mistake. He had already provided water for them by striking the rock with his rod. And the limestone of the Sinai Desert has this peculiar property of holding reservoirs of water within itself. There are huge reserves of water in the Sinai Desert, but they're usually surrounded by rock and contained in the rock. Moses released those reservoirs of water for them, just with his rod touching the rock. But there came a second time when they were short of water, and God told Moses, "Moses, this time, don't strike the rock, just speak to it. A word will release the water in the rock. Just speak to it." But Moses was so impatient with the people that he didn't listen to God carefully. And he said to the people, "Oh, if you want water," and he struck the rock twice. And God said, "Why didn't you do it the way I told you? For this, Moses, you will not see the promised land." Now, it seems a pretty tough punishment, doesn't it? But it was important, because if the leader doesn't listen carefully to God and do it the way God wants, think of what's going to happen to the people. And it was purely because he was angry with the people and impatient with them that he lost his temper and he didn't hear what God said. And yet for that, Moses was told, "You won't see the promised land." Well, you will see it, but you won't enter it. Well, now, isn't the Bible honest? Here are the three leaders of the people, two brothers and a sister. And the Bible tells you they all failed in the book of Numbers. And we're to learn from this. Leaders are to learn from this. Big responsibility to lead God's people. Do it right and do it God's way. There were individuals who let God down through the book of Numbers. The most outstanding was a man called Korah, K-O-R-A-H. And in chapters 16 and 17, we find Korah led a rebellion. He was angry that priesthood should be exclusively the right of Aaron and his family. Why shouldn't the rest of us be priests? Why has it to be Aaron? And he questioned Aaron's priesthood. Now, it's very interesting that as soon as he began to, others began to. It's amazing how one malcontent somehow instinctively finds the others. You ever notice that? It happens in churches, we've got to say it. Happens in the new people of God. One malcontent can soon gather around them a number of others. They almost instinctively know who to go and share their complaint with. And so very soon they had 250 gathered around them, all challenging the authority of Moses and the priesthood of Aaron. Exclusive rights. We didn't elect you. We didn't appoint you. But God had done. So they set themselves against the leaders. In other words, they're saying, they did say, Moses and Aaron are self-appointed leaders. They've chosen this job for themselves. They couldn't believe that God had chosen them. And in any case, they said they failed to bring us into the promised land. That's a nasty dig, isn't it? They failed to get us into the promised land. And they're monopolizing the functions of priesthood. So Moses said, right, we're going to test this. And the test is, who did God choose for these positions? He said, now, Korah and the men with you, get hold of a twig from a scrub bush in the desert. And Aaron, you get hold of one. And they laid these twigs in the holy place before the Lord all night. And in the morning, one of the sticks had blossomed. And one had flowers on it. The others were dead. And it was Aaron's rod that budded. From then on, they actually put Aaron's rod inside the Ark of the Covenant. And it was kept inside there. It was God's proof that Aaron was his choice. He was not self-appointed. And that should have been the end of the rebellion. Moses told the people to keep away from all the rebels' tents. And it says fire came down from heaven. Lightning came and struck their tents and destroyed them all. But Korah saw it coming and ran away. And he and his few followers who managed to escape were swallowed up on some mud flats. Now, one of the dangerous things in Sinai Desert, there are mud flats that the crust is very hard. It's a bit like thin ice on a pond. The sun has dried it off and hardened it. But underneath, it's treacherous swamp. It's like quicksand. If you've seen the film Lawrence of Arabia, you've seen one of his companions sucked under like that. And that's what happened to Korah and the few who escaped the lightning. So they all died. Lovely little touch. If you read the Psalms, you find that many of them are written by the sons of Korah. You ever notice that? This man's family didn't follow him. And his children became singers in the temple later. His children were saved, but he wasn't. Korah is mentioned in the book of Jude in the New Testament as a warning to Christians. Don't question God's appointments. And don't be jealous. But what about the people as a whole? The people as a whole also failed. I've spoken about the leaders who failed, some individuals who failed. But alas, I must now tell you that the book of Numbers says the whole people failed, except for two. 2 out of 2 million, that's not very much, is it? Well, now, there were three major failures that the people made. But there was one general one that keeps cropping up. But there are three specific ones. Let's take the general one first. The general problem with the people was grumbling. That's all. So what's wrong with grumbling? A lot. Somebody once said to me, if you grumble about the weather, you're complaining at the way God's running the universe. Did you ever think like that? Somebody else said, you need no talent to grumble. You need no brains to grumble. You need no character to grumble. You need no self-denial to set up the grumbling business. That's quite a statement, isn't it? It's one of the easiest things in the world to do. And we find this is the major failure of the people. They grumbled in their tents. And they thought nobody heard. But somebody did. And it says, God heard it. The Lord heard it. Because even though he was living in the tabernacle, God is also everywhere. and he heard what went on in the tents. They thought because he was in the tabernacle that he didn't know what they said when they went to their tent. What a big mistake. They grumbled about lack of water. They grumbled about the monotonous food. It says they grumbled that they couldn't have garlic, onions, fish, cucumbers, melons, and leeks. That's what they miss most. I remember interviewing a missionary once and saying, "What do you miss most in South America?" And she said, "Marmite." You know, being honest. And they grumbled that they... I mean, all they had was, "What is it? What is it? Breakfast, lunch, supper, what is it?" They missed all that. They grumbled and complained. Discontent probably does more damage to the people of God than any other sin. Would you believe it? And yet it's not a sin that the church usually disciplines people over. And the Lord heard it. And the Lord said, "You've put me to the test 10 times. So there were at least 10 occasions when that was the problem. But there were 3 other crises in which they took the wrong turning. The first was at the oasis of Kadesh. And this really was the worst. It's there today. It's 66 miles southwest of the Dead Sea. And it's the most beautiful oasis. Beyond it is a bit more desert. And then comes the Promised Land. When they got to that last oasis in the Negev Desert, they sent 12 spies, one from each tribe, to spy out the land and to come back and tell them what it was like. They spent 40 days, some of them in the south around Hebron, but many went to the far north. And they found it a very fertile land. In fact, they came back. That's a perfect illustration, a photograph taken in Israel, of a land dripping with wine. Dripping with wine. Doesn't that seem to drip with wine? They came back with grapes like that from the Promised Land. But they said it's unconquerable. The beautiful land, it's all God promised, but we'll never take it. It's a land that will devour our people. We won't devour the grapes. We will be devoured. 2 of the spies said, "God's with us. He didn't bring us this far to leave us in the desert. We're going in with God." But the other 10 said, "No, it's been a huge mistake. We should never have left Egypt." The crowd actually wanted to stone Moses and Aaron for bringing them all this way. Now bear in mind, it's only been about 3 months since they left Egypt. But they're prepared to kill Moses and Aaron for bringing them out of slavery. It's a tragic situation. Joshua and Caleb agreed that the land was well fortified and that it was inhabited by much bigger people. That was a point they made. There are giants in there. Well, on the whole, Hebrew slaves are quite small. We know that from old bas-reliefs on which they appear. Compared with other peoples, they were not large. And the Canaanites were large. But more than that, they said they have walls around their cities. One of the loveliest things that Joshua and Caleb and Moses said to the people then was, "God will carry us on his shoulders." I can remember as a boy being carried on my father's shoulders. And when I was on his shoulders, I was the giant. I was bigger than everybody else. And I could look over those high garden walls. And what Moses is saying is, God will take you in on his shoulders. And you'll be the giant and you'll look over those fortified walls. But they didn't believe it. They put their faith in what man saw and what man said. And they were thoroughly democratic. They took the majority verdict. Democracy is not the way God usually works. The majority can be terribly wrong. But it was 10-2. And they believed the majority. And defeatism set in. Interesting to contrast what the 10 said with what the 2 said. The 10 said, "We are not able to take it." The 2 said, "God is able to take it." Very interesting. We are not able. God is able. There's no contradiction between that. But the problem is which looms uppermost in your mind. Also, the children of Israel said to Moses, "The land to which you sent us." Whereas Moses said, the land God gave us. Now once again, there's a complete difference in the way they talk. The way people talk reveals whether they've got faith or not. I remember once at one stage in one church, at our elders' meeting, we forbade the use of the word problem or difficulty, and we insist on using the word opportunity instead. It's amazing what difference that makes. You know, as soon as something is suggested, well, I can see an opportunity there. And it changed our thinking to change the word difficulty into the word opportunity. I'm not now advocating the power of positive thinking, but the way we talk reveals whether we've got faith. And someone who always responds, oh, I can see a problem with that, or I can see a difficulty with that. Or there are some church members, they always have two reasons for not doing something new. We've never done it, or we did it and it didn't work. And there's a kind of depression can set in. This is the grumbling, complaining again, the negative outlook, the pessimism. And Moses interceded, but God swore that not one of that generation would ever get into the land. When God swears, that's pretty terrible. Do you know what he says? He says, by God, you won't get into that land. Except he doesn't say God, he says, by myself. Because he can't swear by anything higher than himself, so he swears by himself. And there are many times when God swears by himself. He's virtually saying, by God, you won't get into that land now. By myself have I sworn, you will never enter my rest. Need to take God's swearing seriously. They were 40 days spying out the land. So God said, for every day you've spied out the land and come to the wrong conclusion, you spend 1 year in the wilderness. That's making the punishment fit the crime in God's sight. And that event becomes the hinge of the book of Numbers. It's only a third of the way through, and the rest need never have been written. But the rest is all about this endless journey until every man had died. That was the first huge crisis, and it was the worst. And it meant 40 years wasted time getting nowhere for an entire generation. Sad, isn't it? The next crisis came as they made their way back down into this deep valley. This is a huge crack in the earth's surface. There's the Sea of Galilee, then the Dead Sea, then the valley bottom rises a bit and goes down again. And the crack goes right down through the Red Sea, right down through Ethiopia, right down to the Great Rift Valley in Kenya, and right through Africa. It's the biggest crack in the world's surface. And the lowest part of it is the Dead Sea. You can fly below sea level there and get a pilot's license. It's about 1,600 feet below the Mediterranean. It's a deep, deep crack. And they went down into this valley. It's called the Arava here, the Arava. And they went down into it, down a steep valley, which is called the Valley of the Scorpions. It's known for its scorpion and snake population. And once again, they grumbled, and God punished them by sending snakes. And suddenly they were dying of snake bite in this Valley of the Scorpions. You can still go to the valley today. It's a horrible place. Dry, dark, and the snakes everywhere. And they were being bitten. And only when the death toll rose to an impossible position where it seemed as if they'd all die, they cried out to God then. They confessed their grumbling sin. They repented and they begged God to stop the snakes. He didn't actually stop them. He sent a cure for the snake bite. Now it's interesting, he didn't remove the snakes, but he gave them a cure. And he said, Moses, set up a copper snake on a pole on the top of the mountain looking over the valley. And when anybody is bitten by a snake, if they will then look at that copper snake on the pole, they will not die. That's my antidote. And it worked. It was saying, you're still in danger, but you have to do something to get out of it. You have to make a response. And of course, it took faith to do that. They had to believe in it, that it would work. They could have said, oh, that's silly, that won't cure a snake bite. And had they said that, they'd have died. This is everyone who looked, kept their eye on that copper snake. Because ever since, there's been a superstition about wearing copper, as you know. It's supposed to cure all sorts of things. Copper bracelets and things. That's sheer superstition. Well, they had to look, and it says when they looked, they lived. We'll pick that up later. The third crisis came when they got to the plains of Moab. This was the final one. They'd had a number of victories on the way. They'd had a victory over Edom and Moab. They were riding high. And they camped overlooking the Jordan, looking across to the promised land. I've got a photograph, but I think I'll show you that one later. But now they were going to suffer a major defeat. What happened was this. These people living on this side, Ammon, I'm sure you've heard the capital of Jordan is Amman, it's the same word, and the Moabites, they got together and they said, look, we can't let these Israelites come in here. We don't want them taking our land. Very similar situation to today, actually. We don't want them around. And so they hired a Syrian soothsayer. A man from way up in Damascus. Actually, he'd lived on the river Euphrates earlier, but he was now living in Syria, and he was a magician, he was a diviner, and he was a big ass. And he had one too, and his name was Balaam. And this is where Balaam comes into the picture. Because very often in battles in those days, as today, people prayed to win. And often in those days, they would bring in a soothsayer or a diviner to curse the enemy, and to believe that cursing the enemy would mean they'd defeat them. But same thing happens today. The Russians put on a play in Moscow years ago, and it showed the Germans and Russians fighting on stage, and as the play opened and the curtain went up on the battle scene, there was a German chaplain in a box at one side of the stage and a Russian Orthodox priest in a box the other side of the stage, both praying to God that they would win the battle. It was the Russian cynical way of saying, what's the good of praying in war? But people still do. And they seek to get God on their side. And the ancient way of doing it was to get a magician to come in and in the name of gods, pagan gods, to curse the other side. Now here we have the most extraordinary story in Numbers. Here is a pagan soothsayer called Balaam. And yet, they call him in, and they ask him to curse the Israelites in the name of the God of Israel. Extraordinary. And he does it. And we know why he does it, because he likes money. It's as simple as that. And they kept having to offer him a larger fee, because each time he tried to curse the Israelis, he blessed them. Every time he opened his mouth to curse them, I bless you, says the God of Israel. And the kings of Ammon and Moab were furious. He said, well, I can't help it. He said, I just try and curse them, but I just find myself blessing them. So they gave him more money. And they kept upping it. And they kept bringing him nearer to the camp of the Israelis. At first, the first time he tries to curse them, he's a long way off. You can just see them in the distance. And gradually he's brought nearer and nearer to see how many there are, until finally he's overlooking the camp itself, and he tries again. Now, he did at one point nearly succeed, and that's where the story of the ass comes in, or the donkey. And we're told this amazing story that here is Balaam sitting on his donkey, going down a narrow road, a track between two stone walls, and there are many such in the Middle East, just a little track between two high stone walls, and the donkey sees an angel standing in the path, and the donkey won't move. And Balaam beats the donkey because he can't see, and still the donkey won't move, and he beats the donkey and beats the donkey, and finally the donkey turns around and speaks to Balaam. Now, once again, there are people who say that is absolutely ridiculous. But, of course, we've got to remember that animals can be possessed by evil spirits and good spirits. That's surely what was happening in the Garden of Eden. And we know that Jesus sent demons into pigs. But a good spirit can use an animal just as well. An angel can use an animal. Make of it what you will. But the animal had more sense than Balaam. That's the message that very clearly comes through. The animal was more sensitive. Sometimes animals can be more sensitive to things that are happening than human beings. But it really puts Balaam down at the bottom, below his donkey. It's a sad story because of the sequel. You must read all about it. But in fact, Balaam finally hit on the way of getting the money from the kings of Ammon and Moab. He said, look, trying to curse them is no use. The Lord just twists my words or he stops me getting anywhere near them. I can't do that. But he said, I can tell you a way to get in among them, and this is very significant. Oh, they said, how? He said, send some of your pretty girls into the camp. That's all. It's deadly. They said, oh, now that's good thinking. And they gave them lots of money now. And the girls came in. And it's really too sordid a story to dwell on. In fact, one man in the Israelite camp is commended by God because he actually stuck a spear right through a couple having intercourse at the door of the tabernacle. They were fornicating in God's tent. And this Israelite was so horrified that he pinned them both to the ground with a spear. But he was the only one who resisted the temptations that came. And so that's how they suffered their third major defeat. And Balaam is to blame for it in a sense, but the man who pinned that couple to the ground with a spear was called Phinehas. And forever afterwards, he was given a perpetual priesthood for himself and his family. The only man to defend God's house against what was happening in God's sight. Important lesson to learn. You see, if they were going to go into the promised land, one of the worst features in the promised land was the immorality of it. There were fertility goddesses. There were horrible statues and phallic symbols. They'd just put up an 8-foot-high phallic symbol in the high street in Basingstoke. It's coming back. It's all coming back, the whole fertility cult thing with its immorality. And here they were before they went into the land, faced with it, and they fell. So it's serious, isn't it? And they had to learn, and God taught them a lesson. Well, now, what can we learn from all this? Written for the Jews, of course, for later generations, that they might learn to fear God. And therefore written for Christians, I believe, that we might learn from their failures. In the little letter of Jude, who was Jesus' younger brother, we have mention of both Korah and Balaam. We have many mentions in the New Testament of don't grumble. It was as big a problem in the early church as it was in Israel. It's called a bitter root, a root of bitterness that can grow inside a fellowship when people grumble and complain. Of course, nowadays they usually move on to another fellowship, but boy, if you start a new fellowship with complainers from another fellowship, you're going to be in trouble. You deserve everything you get. If you start a new fellowship, start it with new Christians. Don't build with second-hand bricks. Well, they could live and die in the wilderness. We are more important to God. We're not numbers. We're names. We're not just on his census. He knows how many hairs there are on our head. When I look at the book of Numbers, I'm first impressed with what this book says about God. There are two sides to God's character, and Paul draws them out when he says, behold then the goodness and the severity of God. And nowadays we hear so much about the goodness of God and so little about the severity of God that we are getting an unbalanced, anemic view of God, who is more a mother than a father, or even a grandmother, to quote one bishop. I'm serious about that. And God is a father. And therefore there is severity as well as goodness. There is discipline as well as delight. And we need to get this balance right. So in the book of Proverbs we have his goodness in his provision, in his protection, in his preservation of them. We also have his severity in discipline, disinheritance, disgrace, and even death. We need to remember them both. We deal with the same God. And the fear of God doesn't disappear from the New Testament. It's there with the love of God. What does the book of Numbers say about Jesus? An awful lot. Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness being tempted. He went through this himself. He is the bread from heaven. You all know John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. But do you know the verse just ahead of that? As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That's straight out of the book of Numbers. You can find Jesus everywhere in the Bible if you look for him. Hebrews says, if the ashes of a heifer could bring forgiveness, how much more the blood of Christ? That's a reference. But the most amazing thing is Balaam again. Balaam made a prophecy. And this was the prophecy. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will arise out of Israel. And from then on, every devout Jew looked for the star of the king to come. And that's what led the wise men to Bethlehem. Isn't that amazing? It was Balaam's prophecy that brought the wise men to Bethlehem. I have two more minutes. So what's the best known verse in Numbers? Well, there's no question in my mind. It's chapter 6, verse 24. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you his peace. That's the blessing that God gave Aaron to give to the people when they set off from camp on the next part of their journey. It has every mark of direct inspiration from God because it is mathematically perfect. As Genesis 1 is, incidentally. Whenever God speaks, his language is mathematically perfect. Listen to this. In the Hebrew, of course, not the English, in the Hebrew, there are three lines in that. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you his peace. The words in the Hebrew, three words in the first sentence, five in the second, seven in the third. The letters in the Hebrew, 15 in the first, 20 in the second, 25 in the third. The syllables in the Hebrew, 12 in the first, 14 in the second, 16 in the third. And if you take the word Lord out, you are left with 12 Hebrew words. So you've got the Lord and the 12 tribes. And I could go on. It is mathematically perfect. And it builds up, even in English, there's a kind of crescendo, isn't there? You feel it. And each line has two verbs, and the second expands the first. And blessing, of course, means that the children, property, land, health, safety, they would be protected and provided for. And the Lord is, of course, Yahweh, but it's now Jesus. And the two things the blessing offers are grace and peace, which of course is the Christian blessing in every epistle in the New Testament. Grace and peace to you. And of course, the word Lord comes three times in the Old Testament. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. The Lord be gracious to you. Lord, 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 Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to us. The whole thing is, I could go on, but my time is gone. Mathematically, that blessing is the most beautiful mathematical formula. And so is Genesis 1. You find that God speaks mathematically, which means musically, because music is based on maths. And here we have this beautiful musical, mathematical blessing. So as we finish this talk and you go on your way, I just want to say the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you his shalom. Amen.